Okay, so first of all, thanks for the organizers, I guess Boris in particular, for inviting me. Apart from the nice weather and scenery, I also enjoyed some of the talks, actually.
Really? Really have to work hard to organize the weather.
Yes. So I guess the first thing I should do is apologize for changing the title of the talk. I had a rather presumptuous title that was put on the schedule, but this was sort of because I couldn't decide what I was going to speak on, so I decided to put actually what I'm interested in rather than what I actually have results on as the title of the talk, which I don't think is that uncommon actually for people to do. But because I already talked about finding regulatory sites earlier, I decided to focus on this one topic that I've now, it's something that sort of started a couple of years ago at Rockefeller, some things I noticed, and it's basically some observations about content of genomes that I think are interesting, and there must be some evolutionary explanation for it, and I have some story, and I thought this would be a good audience to bounce the story off of and tell me what everything that's wrong with it. Right. So basically the motivation is sort of this, and many of these plots are now out of date, and I actually tried to update this plot, but it turns out that because of NCBI policies, this is now very hard to do. So this was made a while ago. You just go to the NCBI database, and this is actually just microbial genomes. You pull out the date on each of these complete genomes. So you pull out when it was first deposited in the database, and then you plot as a function of time how many genomes there are. And then you see that through some approximation, they grow exponentially with time. Huh? Yeah, well, okay, so the first time I made this plot, so this is 2.0. The version 1.0 did not show this saturation. Now version 2.0 does, but I actually think that this is wrong, because NCBI has these things that they change the date in these files when they update something, and so this may be really reflective of you know, updating policy rather than when it was first submitted. And now it's really impossible. Well, I'll try to find out, but for a naive observer, it's almost impossible to find out when a genome was first, like Haemophilus influenza, the first one. Right now, all the dates you can find on any of these files are like 2004, which is when they updated. Right. Okay, so this problem. But all I'm saying is that, you know, if you go, this actually, if you do a fit, this is faster than computers, right? So computers, they have this what's called Moore's Law, that there's a doubling time in speeds. I think it's like 18 months or something like this. This is 16 months. So the number of genes is increasing fast, and so the question arises, what do you do with all these genomes? And so when I started doing this, there were maybe 50, 60 bacterial genomes, and it's sort of just about enough genomes to say, start looking at all genomes and look across genomes. Are there some quantitative rules that relate the gene content of these genomes to each other? Are there some laws in there? Or does it just look like it's all over the place? So the thing that I decided to do is very, very simple. It's the simplest thing that you could possibly do, I think. And first what you do is you define a number of high-level functional categories. Right? So for instance, things like genes involved in metabolism, genes involved in the cell cycle, signal transduction, transcription regulation, a very high-level different functional categories of genes, and then you collect all sequence genomes and just estimate the numbers of genes in these different functional categories for each of the genomes. And then basically what you do is, do you see some rules there? Right? As you go across all the genomes in the database, are there some rules of how many genes there are in different functional categories? Okay, so the first thing, of course, that you have to do to do such a thing at all is you have to define what are functional categories. And rather than trying to make it up myself, I just used this ontology called the gene ontology to define functional categories. So what the gene ontology is, it's a collaborative effort between various sequencing projects, annotation groups, and so on, to come up with basically a hierarchy of terms. It's just terms to assign functional annotations to genes. Right, so that's all they're doing. They're just making a hierarchy of terms, and I think it's a fairly democratic thing. If you come up with a new term, you can add it to the hierarchy. So this thing is a directed graph. It's not precisely a tree, but it has a hierarchy. Right? So and there are three hierarchies: one for molecular function, one biological process, and one cellular component. So here's an example of part of the molecular function ontology. So at top there's molecular function, and then subcategories of that are, for instance, binding. This is a very high-level category, and then nucleic acid binding is a subcategory of binding, and DNA binding is a subcategory of nucleic acid binding, and so on and so on. And then eventually here the lamin D receptor, which is a specific gene, falls into hierarchy in this way. Yes. So typically a gene might appear in multiple terms in the hierarchy, and there are also sometimes, the parent path is not unique, right? So the DNA helicase is a subcategory of DNA binding, but it's also a subcategory of helicase. But I'll be looking fairly high level in this tree. Well, many people are using it now. I mean, so with basically all these sequence genomes, you can get Go, like gene ontology numbers for the genes in that genome. So it is
supposed to be a universal.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, recently I think it's gotten a bit out of hand because people can add their categories to this in this sort of democratic way. And so there are now, I think there are tens of thousands of categories. Right, and there must be a lot of redundancy in this, and so I think they are going to have to do something because it's turning into a mess. But this was sort of an attempt. Yeah, that's the next slide. How you assign a gene. So the next thing you have to do is, if you have all your genes in your genome, you have to assign them to these functional categories. And I decided to use. There is this, okay. So the way people automatically annotate proteins into functional classes is you have these databases of protein families and protein domains where people have built hidden Markov models for various proteins, families and very large numbers. So you may know, for instance, PFAM is a database of protein families. There's a TigerFAM. There's a database of superfamilies. This is another database with many transmembrane domain proteins and so on. So you have this whole set of databases that all actually are hidden Markov models, which you can give an amino acid sequence, and they have this set of hidden Markov models for a set of domain and families, and they have some way of running your sequence against those hidden Markov models and say, this is a significant match of this protein to this family.
What's the relation of
these to each other?
Contain collections of all the sorts of proteins, and they're complementary, and they're specialized.
So all that interpro is really a way of trying to remove the redundancy that exists between these databases. So they take families from these different databases and say, this is actually all the same family, so they call that one interpro entry. Okay, so this is also a bit of a messy undertaking, of course, but that's what they're trying to do. And I know that these guys, for instance, they focus on transmembrane domains. I think this thing is sort of like an automated, the domains are defined by clustering analysis of large numbers of proteins. This, I think, is a database that's based on regular expressions. This PFAM is Sean Eddy's hidden Markov database. I think this is one of the better ones, actually. This is just a Swiss version of this. I mean, they started independently, right? And SwissProt is just, this is really manual annotation database. This has really, I think also in Interpro, that if different proteins have hits, and it, one of the hits is in Swiss blot, then that's the default annotation, right? I mean, it's not very clean. None of these things, right?
For
no.
The philosophy is the last one is very sweet and structured.
Yes.
So it's structured because you don't mind small data sets that you can get control.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, no, I just know that these things are now a consortium, so these people, they get together and they decide about the problems they have and what they're going to do about it. Right? But, Nicolaus, yeah.
Wasn't there
even
more
conflict?
Because in order to do the problem, there was more conflict.
What do you mean a conflict?
Well, they, there's something about
yes.
the brain, but for the exact same sequence, this was or something else.
Ah, I think that protein will then go in, if, okay, so that PFAM entry will be associated with one interpro entry, and that SMART or whatever will be, I don't remember what you said, will be associated with another interpro entry, and that protein will then have hits to both. I mean, it won't consider it a clash, I think. No, it doesn't take anything as bona fide. So it has ways of setting thresholds for counting something and not counting something, right? I mean, I'm really not trying to double guess this, but okay, all I want is a way of assigning high-level functional categories that I could apply in an unbiased way across genomes. Because if I go to the database and just take whatever the annotation gives me that is in MCBI, I get something that will very much depend on what that group has done to annotate that genome. And there will be much more variance across genomes in a way that I can't control for because I don't know what they've done. Whereas if I do this, I know my biases are the same everywhere. Right? Okay, so that's sort of why I want to do it like that. Okay, so basically this is the summary. So for each genome, you obtain the genome sequence. You find the genes to translate them into proteins. Typically, this has already been done for you. And then you run interpro all the protein sequences. And when you say you run interpro, it actually runs all these models and then assigns it to an interpro guy. Okay. And when I started doing this, I had to do this myself. And it's actually pretty expensive to run this. But in the meantime, the European Bioinformatics Institute, they've run interpro on all sequence genomes. And so you can download all interpro hits for each genome. So that made my life a lot easier. Okay, and then what what I do is the following. So I go for each protein, for each gene, you look at all the interpro hits. And then there is a file that is generated that maps interpro entries to Go entries. Okay, so there is somebody that is also maintaining a mapping from interpro to Go. And so each hit, interpro hit that a gene has, I can map to some Go category somewhere in the hierarchy. And then I will add a count of one, right, to all Go category to that Go category and all its parents in the hierarchy, right? So if you have a gene and that is annotated for an interpro hit that means chromatin binding, then the Go category chromatin binding will get plus one, but also DNA binding, nucleic acid binding, they all get a plus one, right? So this way I I add the counts everywhere in the tree, and actually what I do in the end is I only keep the Go categories for which there was at least one hit in each genome. And this way I define my high-level categories. Okay. So now the question is, how does the number of genes in different categories depend on the total number of genes in the genome? Yes? Okay, so I use the biological process hierarchy. So this is a hierarchy of biological processes. And there is a category there which is called regulation of transcription DNA dependent. Okay? Anything that is annotated as a transcription factor will map to that GO category.
In terms of the domain,
Yes.
So to get that, and then what? The list of...
So what typically happens is when you run it over the genome, there are sort of like 50 or 60 different interpro entries that are different families of transcription factors or DNA binding domains. Okay?
But this thing looks at domains.
Yes.
So for example, if you look up domains of black eye,
yes.
If I remember correctly, that will have
multiple
DNA binding domains.
Yes.
And will have
yes.
Co-activation
domain.
Yes. But there isn't a domain for interaction with polymerase or anything like that.
Yes. In the interpro there are also protein families, they're not just domains. So LAC will actually have a very, very good match to a family of TETR-like bacterial repressor proteins, right? And
it's not just the domain, it's also
families, yes. Okay, so then the question, first question that you could ask is how does the number of genes in different functional categories grow or change as you change the size of the genome? Okay, so here are example results that you get in bacteria. So on the left panel, okay, so every dot in this graph corresponds to a genome, right? So in these graphs, so this red dot corresponds to a genome with, 1,400 genes, and that gene has 10 genes that fall in this red category, which is signal transduction. Right, so red here is signal transduction, blue is carbohydrate metabolism, green is DNA repair, and on the right, you actually see transcription regulation, protein biosynthesis, and this is actually sort of a control category. This is biological process. This is just how many proteins are mapped to the process hierarchy at all. That tells you the difference, because that might also depend on phenotype. And I've shown the graphs in a log-log plot. And what you, I hope you can see, this is actually just quite on the screen. It goes on here. What you should probably hopefully see is... Yes. So here's E. coli is somewhere here, right? So it tells you that E. coli has 4,500 genes and it has 300 transcription factors. That's what that dot means for E. coli, right? So
transcription regulation.
If you take transcription factor, which is a category in the molecular molecular function hierarchy, not in the process hierarchy, you get the same thing. I mean, even if you take this is what I started with actually a very long time ago. I had a specific program that looks for helix turn helix domains, which is most bacterial regulators have that domain. If you just count that, then this red line will move down, but its slope will not change. So the first thing to note is that there's actually much more regularity in this than I would have expected. Yes. What is not in biological process is proteins that have no annotation whatsoever. They don't have any interpro hits. Or they have interpro hits, but they are not mapped to the biological process hierarchy. So it might, for instance, be that you know where this thing is. So it's mapped to the cellular localization hierarchy. So it's annotated that you know it's a membrane protein, but other than that, you don't know what it is, right? So, but this roughly should have sloped. Right. And you see with almost, right? So it turns out that if you go to a large genome, the number of proteins that have no annotation is going up a little bit. But, you know, very, very slowly. Yes. Yeah, I'll go into all of that. Is there a clue that I'll get to that too? That's the rest of the talk. So, okay. So the thing to notice is that there are some categories where the scaling is sort of trivial. Okay, first of all, there is scaling, right? These are roughly straight lines. That means that the number of genes in the category scales as a power law in the total number of genes in the genome. And the second is that there are some categories for which the scaling is kind of trivial, right? So these two, the two blue ones, the number of genes, the number of carbohydrate metabolism genes is roughly proportional to size of the genome. So if you go to a genome that is twice as large, you get twice as many carbohydrate metabolism genes. But there are other categories that show non-trivial scaling, right? So in particular, the number of signal transducers and the number of transcription regulators scales almost quadratically with the size of the genome. So every time you double the size of the genome, you get four times as many signal transducing genes and four times as many transcription regulators. Whereas certain other categories, like DNA repair, they scale with, you know, exponents which is sort of two-thirds. So if you double the genome, the number of DNA repair genes goes up, but it goes up slower than the size of the genome. And this is extremely so for protein biosynthesis. This line, it has a non-trivial, you know, it's not flat. It goes up a little bit, but as you increase the size of the genome, number of protein biosynthesis genes goes up only very slowly. Yeah? I don't think that that's a category that is annotated in all genomes, so I don't think that's in mine. But if you want, I could try to look it up. I mean, I have these things set up so that I can look at these things fairly quickly. Yes. I don't know. I could check that too. You're asking, you know, if I were to, but this is messy, right? Okay. I could try to do it and say, you know, look at how many different interthrow entries are represented. You know, and maybe here they are also all represented, but they have only one copy, and here they all have more copies, or here the number. I would actually, it's probably a mixture of the two. And I don't know if the mixture is very simple to understand. Okay, so yeah, okay. And this is one of the things that I want to do, and I now have a student who is going to do it, but there's a lot of work for mapping these things correctly. Okay, so that was bacteria. So people asked me, what about eukaryotes? This is a very old slide, because I basically don't want to do this for eukaryotes, because I don't really believe it. You could do it this for eukaryotes, but because somebody always asked me, I have this slide. So, okay, so this is human, mouse, Drosophila, C. elegans, right? These are two yeasts. This is Plasmodium, and this is some wacky eukaryote, which is not really, you know, not a free living cell. It's called Theadia theta, which is the nuclear morph that lives inside of the cell. Right? But these were all the eukaryotes I had at that point, and this is transcription regulation, metabolism, and cell cycle. And you see that, you know, the range, first of all, quite astonishingly, these things still sort of fall into straight lines. And I mean, even if you remove these crazy guys below yeast, you know, the lines would not really change that much, right? Which I actually find kind of crazy. And the sort of the general trend is reproduced, right? So transcription factors go faster than linear. Metabolism is roughly linear, and cell cycle is sublinear. Okay, so there's all kinds of reasons why, apart from the low number of data points, it's much harder to fully annotate all the genes in higher eukaryotic organisms. There's still problems. Then there is splice variation, right? So one gene is not one protein. But one gene could typically be many proteins. And actually, I happen to know that if you look at splice variation, transcription factors tend to have more splice variants than non-transcription factors. So it's not so clear if I should be, you know, plotting how many different proteins there are or how many genes there are, right? And also, if you go really to high-level organisms, it starts becoming really unclear what a gene is, because you have all these different transcripts that are generated from overlapping parts in the genomes and so on. So I think there's all kinds of problems with drawing a plot like this. It's probably also the basal machinery. Right, so the RNA polymerase and, you know, mediator complex elements and so on.
All that together?
Okay, so, well, then I guess it's not, right? Then it must be just regulators. Well, wait a minute, right? Because this is 100, right? And this is 200. So it's right, it's 200 for you. I think that's roughly right, the number of transcription regulators. But this is 2 years old, this plot. I should redo this plot. This one?
Yes.
I think this is Cerevisiae. And I think this is Pombe. Right? So this is also wrong, right? I mean, there are less genes. This counts all these small orphs, apparently, that are not real. I don't really want you to look at this. So the bacteria will stand up for the eukaryotes. I'm not so sure. So is this some freak thing that only works for these couple of categories that I showed you? And the answer is no. So there are 150 categories in the Go hierarchy, 54 Go in the co-hierarchy. That are ubiquitous. That is to say, each bacterium has at least one gene in each of these categories. And for each of them, you can make a scatter plot like this, right? Like these scatter plots, and fit a line, and then ask what fraction of the variance in the data is explained by this line. Right? And that's shown here. So this is a fraction of the variance explained by the fit. And this is the percentage of categories that have at least that fraction of the variance explained. So it shows you that something like two-thirds of the categories, more than 90% of the variance in the data is explained by the fit. And once you go to, you know, 85%, so 90% of all the categories have more than 85% of the variance in the scatter explained by the fit. So this happens for most high-level categories, that you could fit it with a scaling law like that. And then here's just some examples of the exponents that you see. So the gray bar gives you the estimated exponent, and the red bar is the error, the estimated error in the exponent. So you see that protein biosynthesis has the lowest exponent, and categories like signal transduction, regulation of transcription, electron transport, those are the guys with the highest exponents. So really the rule that you see is that very basic functions, cell cycle, DNA replication, making proteins, they all have very low exponents, whereas these sort of regulatory categories, signal transduction, regulation of transcription, and transport, they all scale faster than linear. Yes?
Is the error highest for categories with low absolute numbers?
I think so. I haven't made a absolute number error plot. I can do that too much long. You had a question? Well, Nikolaus wants to know what sort of determines the size of these error bars. Why are some error bars small and some error bars large? But see, there are not that many genes in here. It's just this line is much more tight. But, I mean, actually, if you look back, right, this line and this line, right, they're roughly equally high. So the absolute numbers are not that different, but the transcription factors have lower variance than signal transducers. Right? So it's not that generally. Okay. You want more questions? Yes. Well, ion transport and so on, right? They're falls in the category, if I'm not mistaken. Right? No, they're not all overlapping, but some of them are. Yes.
Your
figure categories are super grouping the big categories. Yeah, these are all from this list of 154. So, these 154, there's a lot of redundancies, right? Because I basically mapped all these genes to this hierarchy and then taken all nodes in the hierarchy that have at least one gene for each genome. But this is, of course, redundant. There's still some categories that have very similar function, right?
So you're putting something
that you don't always map to a lead, but okay.
You don't always map
to a lead. Well, so an interpro entry, sometimes there is a protein and it's in a family of proteins that are all known to be kinases, but it's not precisely known what kinase is, so that's a map. That will map to the tree in the location kinase. Whereas some other may be annotated much more specifically, and you may know that it's a particular, you know, histidine kinase or something like that, and so it will map to a lower level in the tree. But what you do is you map somewhere in the tree, and then you add also a count of one to all of its parents. Okay? That's what you do. Yes. 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 Yes, that's a very good question. That is something that I'm also trying to understand. But it's okay. So I think the remark here is, and maybe I'll just put it out here now, is that if all these things were disjoint, right? So if each gene could only go into one category, and you would have a power law for each of the categories, then you would have some really, really weird set of power laws, because together they have to sum up to precisely genome size. So you would have an equation that says genome size is G, then G is equal to some alpha. Right? So that genome size is the sum over categories, some prefact of each category is genome size to the lambda alpha, where lambda takes on all kinds of different values. Okay, so this is, of course, you know, this cannot be true, right? I mean, you can't make a line by adding together really weird. I mean, you might get close to a line, but you will never get a line, right? So there's something wrong here. And of course, what is happening is that these categories, they overlap. They're not disjoint. But the fact that different subcategories still have power laws and their sum sort of also has a power law means that somehow this overlap also has to scale in some way to make this thing work, right? Which has actually put some interesting constraints on it, and I haven't understood yet what. Yes. 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 Yeah, okay. Okay, so this is, I mean, I agree with your sentiments, but it's really sort of a non-issue, actually, because, so, okay, so this is another remark, right? So I'm looking at a factor of 20, 50 all across the thing, and so any reasonable physicist would say, how the hell could you claim to see a power law over, you know, 1.5 decades, right? So, and I agree with this sentiment, but, yes. Yes. Right. Okay. Okay, good. Yes, it might be. But that still is, somehow this constraint has to be satisfied over this range, and that is some non-trivial, gives you a non-trivial constraint. Yes. 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 No, I don't think so. These ones, you mean? Yeah, but see, but well, but this is also metabolism, right? And this is completely different. So, well, the question is, does this fact that when you have a higher level function that follows a power law, then its subcategories also follow power laws? That's because the subcategories are in fact following the same power law. So then it's sort of trivially true that the higher level one also will follow the same power law. But I think it's not always that simple. Okay, let me just move on because I have a bunch of other things. So there's some nice way that you can actually show all these scaling laws in a single graph, right? And that is basically you can map each genome to a point in what you call functional gene content space, right? So you have this high dimensional, 154 dimensional space where each axis corresponds to a functional category. And you can map a genome into this space just by, you know, how many genes do you have in each of these categories. Right, so the first component is, and I'm doing this in a log space, right? So the component along the first axis is the number of genes in the first category, the second axis number of genes in the second category, and so on. And so then the set of all genomes will form some sort of a cloud in this functional gene content space, right? And the statement that all these that the number of genes in these categories scales with power laws and the total number of genes is actually equivalent, it's very easy to see this, to say that genes approximately fall on a line in this high dimensional space. Okay? So basically what you can do, this line is precisely the first principal component of this cloud of points in this functional gene content space. So what you could do, it's really a pity that this thing is it sort of...
Or not that, you have to rescale your screen.
I have to rescale my screen. Okay, I won't rescale my screen. So this is actually a projection of this high-dimensional cloud of points onto the first three principal components. This is the first principal component, the second and the third. And here, just to give you an idea, these are different cross-sections. Right, so if you project it on how many genes in lipid metabolism, transcription regulation, protein biosynthesis, you get this cloud. These are other ones. Right, so this is just giving you an idea what the shape of this cloud looks like. And you see that it's roughly true that all the genomes fall along a fairly narrow tube in this high-dimensional space, whereas a priori there would have been no reason for the genes to be distributed like that, or the genomes to be distributed like that. I mean, you might notice that there's a group of genes here that is sort of separated from the rest that show a lot more variance. And these are all small genomes, and I think these are all parasites. Okay, so the first principal components of this major axis of this cloud in genome space, so you can look at what categories are at the top of it and what categories are at the bottom of it. So as we already saw, the top categories are the signal transduction, regulation, transcription. At the bottom, you have ribosomal RNA modification, ATP metabolism, protein biosynthesis. I think this is actually mainly, if I'm remembering correctly, it's just loading of tRNAs. Things that are involved with loading the tRNAs. And then you can also, of course, you can put each organism, you can ask where does it map onto this principal axis, and so I'm showing you the top organisms and the bottom organisms along this principal axis, And so basically what you find is these Streptomyces species and Rhizobium species, they lie along the top, and these very small parasitic organisms lie along the bottom. So roughly speaking, I think this is sort of a bacterial complexity axis, and on the top are the most complex bacteria, and on the bottom is the simplest one. And this tells you these different categories sort of are a fingerprint of complexity. So I mean, what I think is nice about that is that, actually, maybe I should show you the next slide first. Right, so you can ask, to what extent is the variance really dominated by this first principal eigenvector? Right, so you can look at the first principal component, the second one, the third one, and so on. And what I've plotted here is the ratio of the relative size of variance explained by consecutive components. Right, so the first principal axis explains about 3.7 times as many amounts of variance as the second one. The second one, you know, 1.3 times as many, and so on. So you can really see there's one component that explains a much higher level of the variance than all the other ones. Right, so the first principal axis captures 22% of the total variance, the second 6%, the third 5%, and you have to use 55 axes to capture 95% of all the variance. So basically what I'm claiming is if you look at this, you get a signal in the first component, and then afterwards it sort of immediately peters out. So that sort of means that really, to a first approximation, the difference in gene content across all these bacterial species is a one-dimensional variable. Right? So as you go from very small genomes to very large genomes, you're basically staying close to this line of functional gene content space. And there is some rule that tells you that as you go up, then your transcription factors have to grow roughly quadratically, and your DNA repair genes roughly with a power 2/3, and so on and so on. So there's sort of a common organizational structure of all bacterial genomes. Yeah. I don't think it means anything. I can show it to you, but okay, so now what are some of the consequences of this thing, right? Well, one of the first things, of course, that comes to mind is that if the number of transcription factors really grows with this exponent, then if you extend genome size to the right, at a certain point, you would have more transcription factors than there are genes in the genome. And this, of course, you cannot have. So either the scaling law has to break down, or there is some upper bound on gene size, right? And if you just very naively ask where do these two lines cross, you get 70,000 genes. So that's much, much more than the number of genes in every bacteria, because the bacteria has top 10,000 genes, roughly, that we know. You can do a little bit, you know, then you could start trying to talk this number down, right? So since I published on this, some physicists have gone and said, oh, we can talk this to 10,000 using some tricks, right? So one of the things you could do, which I think still makes some sense, is that you say as the genome grows, you cannot grow the number of transcription factors faster than the total number of genes. Right, so if you add one gene to your genome, you can at most add one transcription factor. Right? Of course, it's not completely true, because you could, in principle, add one gene, remove a couple of others, and replace them by transcription factors. Right, but if you assume that doesn't happen, then you say that the change in the number of transcription factors has to be small or equal to the change in the total number of genes. So, and then, so you equate the slopes, right? Yes. Yes. Okay, so I'm saying it's not a completely crazy assumption. I'm not saying that I completely believe it either, but this is at least something, you know, you could say. Then you get this equation, and then you'll get an upper bound of 34,000 genes, which is still too large by a factor of 3. And now, of course, what you can do is to say, well, but you use this equation, right, and you should have really fitted the quadratic, because it's close to a quadratic, and then, you know, it will be a bit steeper, and it will matter here, right? And then you can get to 20,000. Okay. 10,000 is just observed. There are no bacteria bigger than 10,000 genes, roughly. Now maybe there is someone somewhere hiding with 20,000 genes, right? But I think that bacteriologists don't believe that for reasons that I can't really, but they seem to be convinced that 10,000 is sort of... Okay, so I personally actually believe that it is true, I mean, this is just a belief, that somehow this upper bound in genome size is set by an overhead of regulation becoming too big in some way, and that this sets a bound. But I also believe that this simple argument doesn't work yet. So there is a more, there's some more, and what you can also do, this is just the number of transcription factors, so you can add the number of signal transducers, right? Also pushes your thing up a bit, right? But I haven't seen any tweak that gets you below 20,000. So I don't think it works yet. Okay, so the other thing, that this is I actually find very interesting, is that it has consequences for the topology of the transcription regulatory network, right? Very simple. If these are your regulators, right, these colored balls, and these are your genes, of course this is, these again, no two disjoint sets, but this is just for viewing purposes, right, then the regulatory network is basically a set of arrows that run from regulators to genes, which means this green regulator is regulating these two genes. Yes? Yeah, but the power laws for eukaryotes and prokaryotes are different anyway. You can't fit those on a single power law. Yeah, but the thing is, we have genomes with 8,500, 9,000 genes in it, right? So, and they fall happily on the line. So you don't see the line sort of bend over at close to what, you know, the top is. So. Okay, so, yeah. Because the transcription factor is a gene. You can't have more women than people. Right? Then it's very trivial, right? Okay. Yeah? Yes. Yes. Actually,
the biggest problem with trying to do it is there any way of falsifying it, whatever the case may be?
Yeah, we could talk about that. No, I mean, okay. But here's the observation, right? So in the genomes with in the largest genomes we know, the number of transcription factors is 15% of the total. So, I mean, that sort of tells you how far away you are from the saturation, right? Okay. Okay, so the transcription regulatory network. Okay, so now you can count the total number of arrows in this graph in two ways, right? You could say I can take the number of regulators and multiply by the average number of outgoing arrows per regulator. Or I could take the number of genes and multiply it by the average number of incoming arrows per gene. That gives you the same number, namely the total number of arrows in this graph, right? So that means that the number of transcription factors, regulators, times the average number of outgoing arrows. Is that true? What I'm saying? Yes. Is equal to the total number of genes times the average number of incoming arrows per gene. right? But we know that this grows roughly quadratically with the size of the genome. So that means that the ratio between the number of incoming arrows to the number of outgoing arrows, number of incoming arrows per gene, number of outgoing ones per regulator, has to grow linearly with genome size. That is, because the number of transcription factors grows faster than the total number of genes, either in large genomes, each gene has to have more inputs, more regulators regulating it, or each transcription factor, on average, should regulate smaller sets of genes. Right? Or a combination of the two, that, but together they have to give rise to this roughly linear ratio. I think that's already... Actually, I mean, this was the question that started me doing this, right? Because I was interested in the transcription regulatory network. I want to know, as you go from small to large, does it have the same sort of topology, or does the topology change? And it tells you that the topology sort of has to change, because this ratio has to go up linearly with genome size. I think that's the principle is an interesting thing to note. And so now you can ask, okay, so which of the two is it? Is the number of outgoing, is in large genomes, are regulators still on average regulating the same number of genes, but all genes have more inputs? Or is it that that regulons get smaller, that regulators start regulating smaller sets of genes? And one way that you could, for instance, look at that is to say, well, if you get more and more sites per gene as you grow the number of genes in the genome, you would maybe expect the intergenic regions to expand, and maybe the number of and also longer operons to break into smaller subgroups. Right? Of course, it doesn't have to be like that. It's something that you would expect. So what you can do is you can estimate the number of operons in different genomes as a function of the number of genes. And then what you get is this scatter. And so, you know, there's not much. So it looks like, yes, if you go to larger genomes, you tend to get operons that are a bit smaller than when you go to small genomes. But the change is, you know, at most a factor of 3 over this entire range, where the change in the number of transcription factors per gene grows like a factor of 20 over this range, right? So, and the other thing that you could look at is the size of the intergenic region. So this is how many intergenic bases per gene. Right? And you see that there's absolutely no correlation. So the intergenic regions in bacteria, in bacteria with many genes or in bacteria with a very small number of genes, completely, there's no correlation there. Okay. So these two things sort of indicate that probably the number of inputs per gene can't be really growing linearly with size of the genome. Right? So I believe that, there's no proof, but I believe that given these numbers and given that there's really no correlation here, you don't see the intergenic regions expand at all for larger genomes, then probably regulators are starting to regulate smaller sets of genes as you go to bigger genomes. But, I mean, a caveat there is that probably in these very small genomes, on this end of the scale, many genes are not regulated at all. They just have constitutive expression, right? And maybe you can also get already a large increase in the number of regulators per gene by just increasing the number of genes that are regulated at all. And that you won't show up in the size of the genetic region. Yes? Yes. Yes. Well, it's kind of crowded if you put 10, right? So maybe you could put 8. Huh? Yes. But then why isn't it shorter in these small genomes? Right. Okay. No. Oh. I looked at that, but it's not going up very fast. there is a little bit of a signal that if you ask the number of genes that have multiple annotations, right, does it get bigger in larger genomes? I think it gets a little bit bigger, but not really convincing. Okay, so the other thing that I think has some interesting, at least, you know, may change your way of thinking, is this idea of combinatorial control, right? So when I was explained what this idea of combinatorial control of transcription factors of gene regulation means, is the idea that, you know, you have a genome with G genes, and each of these genes wants to be regulated in a particular way, right? It has to be regulated in a particular way. And so, so each of these genes has some sort of desired expression profile, right? That you need to, in different conditions, at different times, you have to turn it on and off in some way. And to implement these G different expression profiles, you use different combinations of binding sites for different transcription factors at different genes, right? The idea being that here these colored little plates are transcription factor binding sites for different transcription factors, that you can use a smaller number of transcription factors to get sort of an exponentially combinatorially larger number of different expression profiles by using different combinations at different genes. Right, so roughly speaking, if you have R different transcription factors and you use K different regulators at each gene, you can generate R to the K different expression profiles. Right. So the number of regulators you need for G different expression profiles should grow as R to the G to the 1 over K. So now, of course, we don't know what K is, and K varies from gene to gene, but in any case, the number of regulators should grow slower than linear, right? Because the lowest is 1, and then it would be proportional to the number of genes. And if you have any combinatorial control, you would predict that it goes, that the number of regulators grows slower than the size of the genome, not faster, right? And what we find, even for eukaryotes, is that it grows faster than linear, right? So when you put it like that, it seems like there's a bit of a paradox here, because we know combinatorial control is real. K can be zero. Yeah, but those are genes that don't want to be regulated. Right? Okay. Yes. Okay, so it's true. Yes, there is a caveat here. I actually didn't think of that. But there is a certain percentage of the genes that don't care at all when they're expressed. Right? They're just constitutively expressed. And that, if you scale that in the right way, then maybe you can make it work. That's a good point. Okay. Anyway, so, but I personally actually think that this paradox is really a straw man that is set up by this idea that the number of different expression profiles that you want to do is linear in the number of genes. Right. This is really not what happens. Right. So what you have is you have different regulatory programs. And what these transcription factors do is they implement these different regulatory programs. So each combination of transcription regulators corresponds to a particular regulatory protein, right? The program. And so the number of regulatory programs scales exponentially in the number of regulators, right? But it means that if the number of regulators grows faster than the number of genes, it means that the number of regulatory programs must grow even faster as a function of the number of genes. Or another way to say that is that you cannot associate one gene with each regulatory program. In fact, there are many, many more regulatory programs than there are genes. And regulatory programs use genes combinatorially, right? The same genes are used over and over in different regulatory programs in different combinations. So this whole idea of sort of taking this gene-centric view and say every gene has a desired program is wrong, right? There is a much larger number of programs, and they use genes in different combinations. So I would say the fact that this grows, the number of regulators grows faster than linear in the number of genes, you say, yeah, combinatorial control of transcription is true. You use regulators combinatorially, but you use genes even more combinatorially. Right? As you go to more complex genomes, And it's really sort of, when you think about it, it's a triviality, right? When you go to more complex genomes, you're basically reusing the same set of genes. The only thing that you're really growing is the different ways of regulating them. But I think it's useful, right, because it makes you realize that that's a more sensible way of thinking about things than what you may have done before. Okay, so now, so this is going fine. So now we're going to get to the real controversial part. So now I want to ask, so I've observed these scaling laws, and let's assume that they're, you know, it's just the data. So what kind of evolutionary explanation can you make up for these scaling laws? And so, so the first thing to do is if this is your genome today, right, so this is your bacteria with the different genes in it being these different little balls and different colors being different categories, then as you trace the ancestry of this genome back in time, the number of genes in different functional categories have been going up and down in ways that we don't know. Right? So back in time, the number of regulators was different, and so on. Right? And so we so there are these unknown functions of time that give you the total number of genes at time t in the past, and the number of genes in each of these functional categories at time t in the past. And what I'm going to assume is that the g and NC of T, they change mostly through duplications and deletions of genes that are in the genome. Okay? So I'm going to assume that if the genome is evolving and its number of regulators increases by one, then that in almost all of the cases that was because a regulatory gene in it duplicated. If it goes down, then it's almost always because you deleted one of the regulatory genes in the genome, right? So what I'm neglecting here is a kinase duplicates and turns into a DNA binding protein. So I'm saying that's rare, and I believe that that's really very rare. And two, horizontal transfer is a small percentage of the total change of gene content over long time. That's a more controversial assumption to make, and I looked a bit at the literature, but okay, so all the people that, the only people that put numbers on the how much horizontal transfer you have are the people that argue that it's a small percentage of what happens to the total. All the people that argue that it's very important horizontal transfer, they just argue that it's very important, but they don't put any numbers. So I believe that they're sort of both true. They're very important. You know, you have these pathogenicity islands and so on, so it has big effects when it happens. But if you look over a long time scale, it's actually less than 10% for sure of what's happening. Okay, so I've decided to accept that, and I'm going to just, in this simple model, ignore it. Right. No, well, but that's still everybody duplicates, right? And everybody deletes. That's fine. Yeah, in Serovice, it's pretty clear, right, that that happened. That's not a problem. I mean, I'm not modeling, such events are not in my model, but I mean, I don't think it's a problem. Okay, so the idea is, you know, at time t in the past, you have a genome with g genes, right? And now, let's look at just the change of the total number of genes in the genome. Right, in some short interval, evolutionarily short interval delta t. So now I'm saying, given the, dependent on the conditions that this organism is living in, and its neighbors, and everything else that it evolutionarily is embedded in, there is a certain fraction of these genes in this genome that could benefit the organism when you duplicate them, and there is a certain fraction of genes that would benefit your organism if you got rid of them, and then all the other ones, you don't want to get rid of them, and you also don't want to duplicate them, right? So there is, so these red guys, these are the guys that would be good if you deleted them, and so the fraction is 4 out of 15, and these green guys, they're the ones that would be good if you duplicated them, and they're 3 out of 15. And all of this, so this depends on time, right? At the time of this particular history of this particular genome. So all I'm saying is that there are these functions, which we also don't know, that if you, what is the fraction of genes in the genome that would help when you duplicate and would help when you delete, right? So now, if you assume that the rate of introduction of duplications and deletions, so the rate at which, you know, per chance a gene gets duplicated or a gene gets deleted, are constant over all genes, right? So that it's not that if you're on the left-hand side of the genome, you have a much higher chance to get duplicated than on the right-hand side, which, you know, I know there's data that says depending on where you are with the origin of replication, there is a bias, but we're going to ignore this, right? So we're just going to assume that there is a constant rate for every gene to be duplicated by chance, and then, you know, the number of observed duplications that you will see is just this duplication rate times the total number of genes times the fraction of the number of genes that would be beneficial or duplicated. And the number of deletions you see is the total number of genes times the deletion rate times the number of genes that would be beneficial when deleted, right? So all I've done now is write the change in the total number of genes in terms of these two unknown functions. So I've replaced one unknown function with two unknown functions, yes? Yes. But then, you know, yes. Let's see. Okay, so this model is very simple, right? So I ignore all kinds of things. But what you just said now, right, I could trivially embed in this function, right? So it's not just the fraction of the genes, but the fraction of duplications that would be beneficial to the organism, right? I mean, it's important to realize that I'm just giving you a way of looking at this dynamics. I'm not actually really solving anything yet, right? I'm just rewriting this dynamics in terms of these functions. Yeah. Yes. Yes. No, they get on the charts twice, right? So if you're both a transmembrane receptor, right? So you're a sensor, but you're internally inside the cell, you have a membrane that's a kinase, right? Which happens with all these two component systems. Then you go into two classes. You go into sensor and you go into kinase, right?
Right. So then. Without changing the ratio of the number of transcription factors to the number of genes, because you could modify something to make a transcription factor.
Yes.
Without adding a gene.
Correct.
One gene
added. Right.
I
don't
know if that's rare.
I would assume that that's rare.
Well, like you have a local function, but not.
Rare. No. But if you get a new gene, if you get a new transcription factor, I would say it's typically through duplication of an existing one and not by taking, let's say, a kinase and messing with its amino acid structure so that all of a sudden it has a DNA binding domain. Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes, that's true. That happens. Right. Right. No. That happens. Okay. So gene fusions and splits are not in here. Yes. I would like to go forward. I'd like to go forward, yes? Okay, then let me go, because I really want feedback on this, because the really weird assumptions are still going to come. Okay, so basically, this is the differential equation I just plotted down. And you can just formally solve this differential equation so that the number of genes at time t is just the integral from time 0 to t of this function integrated over time. Sorry, a little bit falls off here on the side, but it's just a formal solution, right? So now, actually, this integral is really a time average over the evolutionary history of the genome. Right, so this tau integrates over the evolutionary history of the genome, and you're basically integrating what fraction of the genes of the genomes would be beneficial duplicated and what fraction would be beneficial if deleted. So you're basically getting the time average of this quantity over the evolutionary history of the genome. Right? Okay, so now you can write the solution again in terms of these time averages. Right, so it sort of makes sense that your total number of genes is exponential in the time average of what fraction of the genes would be beneficial if you duplicated or deleted it. But of course you could play the same game for the number of genes in a particular category, right? So let's say that these genes in these round balls are the genes in a particular functional category. And so there too, you have a certain fraction, this is, you know, falling off, but there's a certain fraction of the genes in this functional category that would be beneficial when duplicated. This is this guy and that guy. And there is a certain fraction of the genes in the functional category that would be beneficial when deleted, which is this guy, right? And you could write down the time evolution of the number of genes in this category in the same way. So now again, so the formal solution is this, where you now have the averages over the genome history of these fractions of the genes in the category C that would be beneficial when deleted or duplicated. Now, by combining these two, you can basically cancel T out of the equation, get rid of time. And then basically what you get is that the number of genes in category T scales as the total number of genes with this power law with exponent alpha C, where alpha C is this ratio, right, of duplication rate times the fraction of genes on average that would be beneficial when duplicated, minus deletion rate, fraction of genes in the category deleted, and divided by this. Okay, so it's important to realize that really the game that I've played so far is to just rewrite the unknown time dynamics in such a way that I will end up with a formula that has the right shape. Right? It will look like this is a power law in this, because that's what I need to get. Right? Right? Sorry? Yes, alpha. Very good. This is the next thing that I was going to say. Alpha here is a function of time, because it's given by this ratio of time averages, which two things, so it may depend on time, and two, it depends on the evolutionary history, right? Because these are averages over the evolutionary history of this genome. So alpha, in principle, the prefactor and alpha could be different for every genome, right? So I really haven't solved anything yet. What? Yeah, they are, because it's T times the time integral over time. Right, the integral over time is just time average times T, right? It's again a triviality, right?
Why are you putting delta
in time? Huh? Because that's just the general probability of a gene getting duplicated or deleted.
Well, that could be different in different categories.
But that would say different parts of the genome, you somehow know that this is introduction of duplication deletion, not selection of them, right? Okay. No, the selection is on these Fs, okay? That's the point, right? The selection is in what fraction would actually increase fitness when you duplicate them.
So you're basically saying this is growing exponentially,
right,
along the grunt, but you have a way to go, right? Because you have not explained why things scale across the...
Yes, okay, so all... Because it, no, yes. Okay, so all I'm saying, right... Yeah, okay, no, but that is really, I mean, you could put all this in there, I don't think it will make any difference. Okay, good, we can discuss. Yeah, in the limit of very small things. Okay, so, I mean, I know, for very small increases in fitness, it's a nonlinear function, it's true for very small increases. We can discuss this, but this is really not the issue. Okay, I told you we can discuss this, okay? And I personally don't think, I know precisely how to stick this. You know what, I mean, you just introduce another unknown, right? Which is, what is the average size of fitness effects? And then you just integrate over that and then call that F, right? It doesn't change anything because this F is an unknown function. I haven't really made any assumptions.
All you're saying is that everything's growing exponentially.
Yes, that's all I'm saying.
Right. Some effective rate of growth that is determined on selection, duplication.
Yes.
It's just one number.
Yes.
That you cares about.
Right.
You already have four parameters for that one number. That's enough.
Yes. Right. Precisely because of questions like this, I keep adding the number of parameters. Okay. Okay. So now, this, let's say this is the phylogenetic tree of all species living today, right? So you have these different genomes, and each of these genomes has a different history, right? And so there is a different alpha C, because this alpha C was an average over the history of the genome, right? There's this ratio. And so, in principle, this number is different for all the branches, right? So I just showed you that for any particular history, this holds, right? This formula holds, but these alpha C's may be different, and these prefactors could, in principle, also be different. Now, the observation is that the genes, that the number of genes in different functional categories do, in fact, lie, roughly, on a common power law line, right? That's the observation. So that basically tells me that this function is the same for all these evolutionary histories. Right? So now, the fact that these prefactors are the same is maybe not so surprising, right? This is sort of triviality, because all these bacteria that I've looked at, they have some common ancestor sometime in the past. It's the same common ancestor. So they all start from the same initial condition. Right? So that makes some sense. So now, basically, and this is all I wanted to do at the moment, is to say that the observed scaling laws are in fact equivalent to stating that these alpha C's have to be the same for the different evolutionary lineages. Right? Okay, so somehow these alpha C's, which are these ratios of these growth rates for different categories, are evolutionary constants, because if you average them over the evolutionary history of a genome, you always get the same number, no matter what evolutionary history you pick. Okay, so now, what does that basically say? So this number, this ratio of averages, is the same for all evolutionary histories. And a sufficient condition is if you assume that this happens, that it holds independently for duplicating and deletion, right? So, if the average fraction of genes in this category that would be beneficial when duplicated is a given constant times the average over the entire genome, and the same for deletions, then this would be trivially true, independent of what lambda and delta are, right? So basically, by looking at it this way, what you now see is that different categories are sort of have different susceptibilities to evolutionary change, right? So remember, right, what categories where this number was very small was like protein biosynthesis, all the genes that are involved in synthesizing proteins. So what it says is that as you follow this set of genes through time, right, the fraction of them that would help you when you duplicate them and help you when you delete them is typically small, independent of the evolutionary of the environmental conditions. Basically, this module, it works, it does what it needs to do. There's almost no need for duplicating or deletion of genes in this category. Whereas in these categories where this number is very high, right, for transcription factors and single transducers, you say that as the evolutionary conditions change, requirements for transcription factors and single transducers change a lot. So you're duplicating and deleting these guys on average twice as often as you're duplicating and deleting other genes. Right? So what this is really saying, that for each functional category, there's basically a number which summarizes its evolutionary susceptibility, which is as you go through time, how likely is it that it would benefit you to duplicate or delete genes in this category. Okay, so these guys at this end are high susceptibility, these guys at this end are low susceptibility, and you know, if you look at what these functions are, I think it makes sort of sense that, you know, protein biosynthesis is not much use to change it, whereas, you know, regulatory things, they respond to signals in the environment. If the environment changes, the signal is gone, you better get rid of this thing, right? So they're much more susceptible. Okay, so now the final 2 minutes I want to speculate why this number is 2 for transcription factors. Right? So for transcription factors, you have roughly quadratic scaling with the total number of genes. So it says that on average, the fraction of transcription factors that would benefit the organism when duplicated is twice the average of the total number of genes that would benefit, and also for deletions. Right? On average, there are twice as many transcription factors that would be beneficial to be deleted as genes are coded. Right. So now my claim is, my hypothesis is, yes, it's a sufficient condition. Yes. Well, and also because it's independent of lambda and delta. So I know, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the rate of introduction of duplications and deletions is different. And if you want to fit it in some way that doesn't assume this, so where this doesn't hold true, then somehow these things have to be balancing with the rate at which introduction, and that doesn't seem very likely to me. So this seems like a more... But it's in F. That goes in F. The effect on fitness goes in F. It doesn't go to delta. Yes, this is a time average. Okay, so... Okay. With 1,000 genes, yes. Okay, so... Yes, but you could still put that into F of T. Because, you know, T determines the size of your genome that you have at that time. So, I mean, let me... Yes, so...
It doesn't look...
promising.
Is it reasonable to say that the given transcription factor is as likely to be an activator or repressor? Right? If you look at the members of HPL...
Yeah, but some of them are active when they're phosphorylated, and some of them are active when they're dephosphorylated, and some of them are active when they're binding the small ligand that they respond to, or some are active when they're not binding the small ligand they respond to. Okay, so typically what transcription factors in bacteria do is they respond to some signal, right? So LacI, it responds to lactose in the environment. If there's no lactose in the environment, it binds DNA and it represses the lac operon. When lactose appears, the lactose binds the LacI repressor and it lets go of the DNA, and then the lac operon is transcribed. And this is basically the same sort of thing you see over and over again. So LexA, it responds to single-stranded DNA. You have transcription factors that, you know, respond to the level of purine precursors in the cell. If they are present, then you transcribe the purine biosynthesis genes, otherwise you don't, and so on, right? So generally, the simple sort of model is you have some sort of signal, and as the signal goes from off to on, the transcription factor changes its state from inactive to active, or the other way around, and it either starts turning on a set of genes as the signal goes up, or it starts turning off a set of genes as the signal goes up. So it's like a switch, right? And so, so transcription factors, so given the same signal and the same set of target genes, there's sort of two ways that you can have a regulator regulate that. You can either have the regulator turn these genes on when the signal goes on, or you can have the regulator turn these genes off when the signal goes on, right? And so, if you have a genome without the transcription factor, which is insensitive to this red signal, when you now add a transcription factor, you can add it in two ways. You can add it to turn on this set of genes when the signal goes on, or turn off this set of genes when the signal goes on, right? So there's two ways that you can add this transcription factor to your regulatory network, right? Right. So when you turn off, when you remove a transcription factor from the genome, right, there's also two ways that you can remove it, because now you go from being sensitive to the signal to becoming insensitive to the signal. And you can turn either the target genes constitutively on, irrespective of the signal, or turn them constitutively off, irrespective of the speaking hole, right? And metabolic genes, right, I think this is the last slide. So metabolic genes, you don't have that option, right? When you add them or remove them from the network, you're just adding or removing a particular reaction that they catalyze, right? So my wild hypothesis is, I told you that the more controversial things we have done, is that this quadratic scaling is because of the fact that these transcription factors act like switches, and so you can add them to the network in two different ways, and therefore there's the rate at which, you know, these things are added is twice as high as for other genes, and this is true both for deletion and for duplication.
So what is the relation from the source?
Yes. So let's step back and think about what really happens, right? Okay, so I think it's finished. Is it finished? Yes, it's finished. I'm done.